Thank you for listening to Classical U's podcast, for following us with our courses, training teachers, parents, school leaders on classicalu.com. On the podcast, we interview guests that are recording with us, leaders and authors that we're in conversation with related to how to run a great classroom, how to deliver the liberal arts, great books, classical languages to your students. We also have a webinar series, live learning events, that is in collaboration with Scholae Academy and Scholae Communities. Encourage you to watch for those as well. Those are monthly, and we're delighted to have you. Thank you. It's great to have you recording with us, Amy. Updating a course that you have with Classical U. I know the course comes out of your Master of Arts in Teaching, the graduate course that you teach at Eastern University with the Templeton Honors College. And you're a affiliate professor of philosophy there at Eastern University. And we're also bringing out, as well as updating the course, we're bringing out a book with Classical U imprint of Classical Academic Press. Disability and Classical Education will be the course and book title. And you also have a even more substantial book on the same topic, developing and expanding on it, that will be coming out later with Classical Academic Press as one of our monographs. So wonderful to be working with you today. And thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jesse.
The topic of your book, you've been speaking on this topic and teaching the graduate course. How many years have you been teaching that graduate course?
I think the first time we offered it was in 2018, so math is not my strong suit. Like five, right?
Yeah,
this will be the sixth time through.
Yeah. What are some of the takeaways that you think the in-person students in your master's degree mm-hmm. program, you know, what are some of the top takeaways you think they've had? And then I'll ask you know, what are some of the ones you'd hope they have? Just a slightly different variation on the question.
Yeah, fair enough. I've had really good response from the students to this course. I think they don't quite know what to mm-hmm. expect coming into it. The title is Difference and Human Dignity in the Great Tradition. And that could go any number of directions, I think, when they come in. But in the first week of that course, we dive really deeply into questions of what it is to be human through the lens of disability and difference. And mm-hmm. I find that first week is really transformative for the teachers that come to our program to just mm-hmm. have that time to spend. They're working teachers. They're busy teachers. Right? They don't often just get to sit with these questions for that long. I have them for 3 hours a day for 5 days that first week.
Yeah,
so they're getting into it.
It is a deep dive. Yep.
And they have told me again and again that that was really impactful and powerful for them mm-hmm. in kind of shifting their perspective on what it is to be human and on their desire to welcome certain kinds of students into their classroom.
Yeah.
Even if they came in with kind of course we want to welcome everyone, the kind of why that first week provides, I think they found really powerful. And then the second week of the class kind of really unpacks, okay, I've told you why I think you should do this, and we've unpacked it together from eight different directions.
Yeah.
How do we do it?
Yeah.
Right. How do we start to think about this? Let's learn about certain kinds of disabilities. Let's learn about the way that those kinds of students can be best assisted in the classroom.
Yeah.
And I get stories all the time about teachers who have gone back and changed their classrooms. So I had one teacher tell me really recently, this made it into the lecture actually, that she set up a sensory corner this year.
Mm-hmm.
And that the mother of one of her students with autism came in and was like, whoa, what did you do? This is awesome. Right? This is perfect for my son.
Yeah.
And so I just love hearing stories like that. I'm very humbled by them, to be honest, to see kind of how planting that seed gets taken out to meet kind of children and families in real time.
Wonderful. Well, it sounds to me like your answer to the second question would be pretty similar. I mean, you know, you're really seeing fruit that you're mm-hmm. you know from the seeds that you're seeking to sow. So you know your own objectives for the course. It sounds like a very rewarding kind of experience.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I always kind of, I want to survey, you know, it seems very self-serving afterwards, be like, so tell me how this changed what you do.
Yes.
Right. But I find it very gratifying to hear those stories. And I just hope that they continue. And I hope that my continuing research, the more I talk about it, the more I read about it, that I would get better
mm-hmm.
At it so that this message can reach more students and more schools, because that's why I do it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you mentioned reaching more schools. It sounds, you know, this has got to be a topic I've been you know, teacher and administrator in classical schools and serving here at Classical Academic Press, as we serve schools in a variety of ways, this has to be an area that's a little bit outside of the kind of comfort zone and familiarity of some classical schools. Is that what you find? It's kind of a pioneering territory? Is that an accurate assessment or description in your experience?
I'm reading the Laurel Ingalls Wilder books with my kids, so I hope they were pioneers in some sense. Yeah, I mean, I found, and I say this in the lectures as well, when I first set out to teach this course, when I was designing this course in 2017, 2018, I was trying to find classical schools that were doing this. I was trying to find literature on it. Mm-hmm. And at that time, and I think still until this book comes out very soon, very excited, there's one book.
Yeah, yeah.
On this topic in the world. And it's Cheryl Swope's wonderful book, Simply Classical.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a great one. But one? Right? We live in a sea of words all the time, and I found it really striking that people don't seem to be talking about this.
Yeah, that was a book I shared with faculty years ago at Logos Academy, and it was a great blessing. But you're right, an incredibly challenging and topic with so much, both on the side of what needs, you know, why we should be doing this, advocating, and the depth of reasons there, which I want to get into, but also on the how-to, because it is intimidating. We have limited resources and capacity, and you know, sometimes you have to be honest about that. And it's just even if you're thinking I might be able to do this, there's good reason to pause and there's hard questions, you know, to be asked. So it's exciting to be a part of bringing another resource to the table. And I hope, I do hope more schools are picking this up. It sounds like, you know, your course is divided into the why and then the how.
Mm-hmm.
Your own background as a philosopher probably speaks more directly to the why. The how, where are you finding your own resources and the research, and, you know, how are you bringing the how to people?
Yeah, and I think this is a really important thing that you've never taught in a special ed classroom. What are you doing talking about this? You didn't say it like that, which I appreciate. But no, I think it's a really important question. The answer is kind of multifold. So when my former dean, Jonathan Yonan, first suggested that I teach this course, you know, oh, you do philosophical anthropology. You can teach a course for classical, I mean, what, special ed for classical schools. Okay. Can I now? And that was just, it ended up being the kind of richest invitation I have ever received in my career. You know, I was a young professor at that point. No, not so much any longer. and so, you know, you're a young professor and your dean asks you to do something. Yes, of course I can do that.
Yeah.
But I spent the next about 2 years giving myself what I would consider an extremely eclectic second master's degree. In all things kind of special ed and... In so from the kind of home base, you know, philosophy and theology of disability, right?
Yeah.
All of that research was kind of very much in my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
But then also looking at the special education textbooks, learning about universal design, starting to think through, starting to read about these individual disabilities, reading memoirs, reading kind of teachers' reports, talking to teachers, asking them, right? Part of my work for the longer book has been touring around to schools and asking the people who are doing this.
Field research.
Yeah. What's working for you, especially when I can find those gems of programs that really are doing this in a deeply classical way, asking them how that works for them. And so I've really tried to integrate kind of the best evidence-based research into what I offer to my students, both in the on the on-grounds course at Eastern and in my courses here.
Yeah.
And so while there's no substitute for kind of boots on the ground work, I've really tried to... make it accurate. And I've had teachers who are themselves have a deep background in special education tell me that what I was saying was accurate. Right? So I've really appreciated that confirmation as well, that they thought that the way that I framed it was helpful.
That's great. Are you comfortable sharing a little, you know, some of the reference programs that are doing this particularly well? Are there any kind of models, examples, and also special education teachers, you know, who are practitioners that you would kind of recommend or reference?
So the two that I've toured so far are Trinity Classical Academy and the Imago Dei School within the Trinity Classical Academy out in Valencia, California, and the Immaculata Classical Academy down in Kentucky. And both of those schools, they're different, but they've both been doing it a while. And so that seeing not only programs, but established programs in classical schools that are really serving students with all different kinds of needs has been really powerful for me. So they're doing wonderful work. And I can, if you'd like me to, I can speak a little bit about what they're doing and what the differences between the two approaches are.
That would be a great help.
Okay. So Trinity Classical Academy and the Imago Dei School out in California, they didn't start out with programs or with explicit programs, especially not for students with the kind of most severe needs. But it was always part of their goal. They were always working towards that goal, they told me, especially because, and this is such a common story in schools I found that are doing this, the child of one of the founders had needs. And they really wanted him to be able to participate in this school. And so their school has multiple tracks. So they have the Imago Dei School that's within the broader umbrella of the school, and that is a self-contained classroom or school, kind of school within a school model for students who really were not going to thrive in a completely kind of mainstreamed inclusive approach. They just need that one-on-one attention more. And so that's the kind of school within a school, and there are various ways that they integrate those students into the broader school. They're really intentional about doing that, including reading some of the same texts, but in an abridged level, these kinds of things, putting them in their house system. Having the biggest fundraiser for the, I think the biggest fundraiser for the whole school, I think this is accurate, is a run to support the Imago Dei School. And so it's just baked into their culture. And then in addition to that, they have a couple of different tiers of support within the kind of, for lack of a better term, general education classroom. And so they're developing that, right? They had kind of one tier of support. They thought it wasn't enough. And so they were, as I was talking to them back in 2020, they were developing a new, I'd love to check back in with them now and see how it went. They were developing a new kind of track that was not a Imago Dei school, but more pullout, right? And they were funny. They said that they have great energy there. And they basically said, you know, we're notorious for kind of building the ship as we're sailing it.
I think a lot of classical schools have had that experience, certainly,
So that's the one kind of school within a school model. And then Immaculata Classical, from the very beginning, was designed to welcome students, specifically students with Down syndrome, but students with other learning needs as well. And so from day one, they had that integrative mission. Amazing. And it's unusual, but in talking with them, it's huge. Because it means that nobody's confused when this is part of your mission from the beginning. And so I think that's a real message for school startups, right? Make it in from the start.
Ask this question.
Ask this question right out of now. The gate. Don't think, oh, I'm going to set everything up and then we'll figure it out later. And they do a full inclusion model. So they certainly have pullouts for particular students, but the students are housed within the individual classrooms, grade level classrooms. And they were, it was just delightful to see where they are and the stories coming out.
And what year was that?
That was just last year in 2023. Okay. That was last fall. So,
well, thank you. That's great. How would you summarize the you said like from eight different directions when you're talking about the why, you know, with your your in-person graduate course. But what are some of the highlights, you know, that you are able to get into in the more kind of condensed, you know, classical U course and book of the why?
So the place that we start with the why is actually with a deep dive or a fairly deep dive into the history. And so we're going back and we're reading Plato, we're reading Aristotle, we're finding the passages in those ancient texts that are so central to the classical tradition. We're seeing what they say about people with disabilities. Right. And so the idea is to kind of trace the idea, the development of the idea of disability throughout history. And I'm just not able to do that in a six lecture course. You'll get some of that in the bigger book. And so we do that. We sit with it. We seminar around these texts to really kind of try to dig in. And then we trace it. Right. We trace it through the medieval period. We trace it through the kind of development, through the development of our ideas about disability when we add in Christianity. Right. How does the Christian perspective speak into what we find in the ancient world? And then we look at what happened when we kind of closed the lid of the world in the modern period, mm-hmm. and we're no longer open to receiving meaning, receiving our telos from outside of us. Yeah. What did that do to people with disabilities? How did that play out? And so seeing how that history unfolds is one key angle that I think we go into in a much deeper way in the class than I'm able to in a kind of abbreviated version.
Yeah. What does that say to classical educators? I mean, what are some of the key challenges that that experience raises for your students?
Yeah. I think as with all ancient texts, it's challenging, right? They say things that are so inspiring, and then in the next sentence, without catching a breath, they say something we find so problematic, like we don't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And so Plato at one point in the Republic just says, you know, if there are people who have chronic illness, we should just not give them medical treatment because they either need to get better or die. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they're just a drain on society.
Yeah.
Okay. Where do we go from there, right? Well, we do need to talk about the conditions of scarcity, right? We do need to try to situate in historical context where medical care meant something different.
Yeah.
But then we also need to figure out kind of how does that fit into Plato's broader picture? Mm-hmm. How might a Christian understanding really have to challenge that?
Yeah.
And so I think grappling with these texts is really crucial in understanding our own history, because sometimes you'll see us saying similar, you know, we think we've evolved, we've progressed so far, but you look at some rhetoric now, we talk about lives that aren't worth living.
Yeah.
Right? That has a strand all the way back to what Plato is saying. And so I think we're always tempted to kind of stand from our kind of progressive height and judge the past.
Yeah.
When really, I think that oftentimes it's judging us. Or we've now kind of stepped back into a more pagan way of thinking about things.
Yeah. I know a lot of your resources go back to Augustine.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the standout texts in the Christian tradition that kind of challenge some of these assumptions that we tend to make, you know, as humans or, you know, outside of a specifically Christian challenge?
Mm-hmm. So Augustine has a beautiful passage, and I've kind of really keyed in on a term of his. He is trying to talk about the terminology here. Oftentimes people with physical disabilities in the ancient world are called monsters. Right. And that term actually, alas, continues all the way through the early modern period. And so Augustine's just, I love how direct he is in just addressing questions of his culture head on.
Mm-hmm.
He basically says, okay, what do we make of people who are so obviously different?
Mm-hmm.
Because especially people at that time took disability to be a judgment from God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
What did we do? Right.
Yeah.
To have this happen. Right. And Augustine takes the question, he faces it head on, and he says, basically, we need to understand everything under the umbrella of providence.
Hmm.
Right. He says, look, are we really so shocked that providence might have someone born with six fingers, right, is one example he gives, right? Or someone born with kind of a more twisted body or things like this, where he basically says, we have to allow that people who are so kind of different in obvious ways might have what he calls a strange vocation, right? Might have strange vocations that speak to us in a particular way about the providence of God because they jar us out of our ability to just kind of stop thinking about our world. And that God might have actually a particular call on their lives that we need to be open to. And just think how different that perspective is, right? From a perspective that says, you're not useful.
Right.
And so we need to get rid of you.
Right. It's giving a prophetic role, you know, a particular revelation of the divine in a world that's calloused or, you know, blind.
Yeah.
To the disabled.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think we're all more familiar with, you know, the Christian idea of human dignity and that, you know, every person is, you know, in the image of God. But you're unpacking this even in more generally human terms as well, not entirely relying on the Christian tradition. How do you go about that?
Yeah, so this has been a kind of an editorial choice, for lack of a better term. I think that the fullest way to understand it is when we understand the deep theology behind the Imago Dei and are able to address the questions in terms of the workings of the Holy Spirit, in terms of a kind of understanding of the human being, especially through the lens of the incarnation, and through Jesus' suffering on the cross, that really tells us something, I think, about the place of vulnerability in a Christian anthropology. But I also wanted everything that I'm writing to be kind of accessible to a broader audience. And so when I dig really deeply, as I really hope to do in future projects that are as yet to be, I can't even finish my current ones, right? as yet to unfold, right? I would really love the opportunity to kind of unpack a lot of what I've been saying in explicitly Christian terms. But I made the choice at this stage to stick with more general terms in order to kind of preach as broadly as possible, for lack of a better way to put it, to reach as many kinds of classical schools as possible, to reach as many people as possible, people who might be either turned off or confused by focusing primarily on a Christian terminology. And so I've taken up Wendell Berry's language of the great economy, right? What I find I can't do without is some form of openness to the transcendent. But if you're doing classical education, I would think that in that vague term, this is got to be at least on the table.
The transcendent, the telos,
transcendent
have to be in play.
The telos, the it does. It has to be in play. That's a really good way to put it. And so most of my work, and I'll reference specifically Christian concepts from time to time, and I would be nothing that I say is incompatible with them. But most of it right now is framed in terms of great economy, telos, openness to the transcendent.
So, I mean, there's a sense in which Plato or Aristotle should have known better. and you're calling that out. You know. So what are some of the encouragements to, the person who's thinking of starting up a school? And this is just seems like too intimidating. You know, there's such a long list when you're considering something like launching a new school with a team of people. How can you possibly feel like you've got the resources to consider this and take it seriously and try to go out of the gate, you know, with this philosophy to education?
Maybe it's just occupational bias. but I really do think you have to start with the why. Because I really genuinely believe that once you see how this question of welcoming students with disabilities into your community is, I think, really crucial to getting the anthropology right, to having a school that fully embodies true human community, that leads students towards their telos, right? Once you see, I think, that welcoming students with disabilities is not a tangential issue, but is central to your ability to accomplish your primary mission.
Forming all of the students.
Forming all of the students in that direction, right? Having all different kinds of learners in the classroom forms everybody. And I think once you see that, I would hope that that is kind of the first step towards, right, not how can we, but how can we not? And to say, likely you can't do it all at once, right? You're not going to have all of the supports and all of the systems of Immaculata Classical from day one. You're not going to have the whole structure of the Imago Dei school and all the different levels of support that Trinity Classical had on day one. Guess what? They didn't have it on day one either.
Right.
Immaculata Classical had the kind of welcoming from day one, right? But they didn't have everything hammered out, right? And so to say, okay, what are the few steps we're taking now? The last lecture in the series is just called Think Big, Start Small. What are the small steps that we can take with the hopes that we're going to be building on this as our school grows?
So having the commitment from the beginning is what you're recommending strongly. And think hard about the why questions. Dig in. And then the think big, start small. Take the baby steps that commit you and move you in the direction.
And just one more thing to add there. Talk about it.
I
feel like oftentimes
make it a part of your own reason for being.
And make it something that your teachers feel comfortable talking about. Right? Have it be always something that you're willing to discuss.
That's a big deal. I mean, the kind of professional comfort, you know, faculty are intimidated and frightened in this area. And how do you recommend making it a conversation that is kind of achievable between, you know, administration. Schools have these various constituencies, parents, teachers, administration, and it mm-hmm. can be a really challenging topic between all three of these kind of basic zones, you know, in the school.
Yeah. The more I research disability, the more whenever the topic is raised, it's just a lightning rod.
Yeah, for sure.
Which means like it's just diagnostic, right? Mm-hmm. It just cuts to the heart of things.
Yeah.
Like nothing else I've ever seen. But that can be difficult to navigate. I think one of the main things that I've seen, obviously this is a huge question. So just to kind of give a couple of first thoughts. One of the main things I've seen in schools that seem to have developed helpful cultures around this is that the administration is always asking the teachers, how can we support you?
Mm-hmm.
So in the same sentence that they're saying, we're going to do this,
yeah.
right? They're also saying, what are you struggling with
yeah.
and how can I support you?
Yeah.
Right? Because when you get that top down, we're going to do this, and then the teachers just feel overwhelmed and unsupported, and you've asked me to do something, but I can't do it, and I'm already overworked and underfunded, is most often the case in most schools that I talk to.
Yeah.
That can create a really toxic culture.
Yeah.
Because they're basically being asked to give support that they don't have the training or the resources to mm-hmm. give. Right. And so I would say if you're really serious about doing it, figure out what resources you're going to direct towards it from the start and just have we're going to do this. How can I help you? Right. This kind of collaborative approach. What are you seeing? Right. And this collaborative approach works with parents too. Between teachers and parents, between administrators and parents. So when we think about how kind of collaboration between teachers and parents mm-hmm. and administrators work in the public school system, they're often kind of in these IEP meetings.
Yeah.
And I have heard described over and over again how an IEP meeting is a parent sitting on one side against a panel of experts about his or her child on the other side.
Yes, yeah.
And even the very kind of architecture of the situation is combative.
Yeah.
Even when it's not intended to be.
Right.
Right. And so I think that when we are reaching out to parents from administrators or teachers, asking them how they see their student, mm-hmm. what are your hopes for your child? What are your experiences? What are your wounds that you've acquired along the way so far? And ask that question that way and things will come out quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Getting on the same page of seeing the student as a whole person and seeing whether the school is the best fit, or if we've decided the student is here, how we can best support them within the resources of our school together, I think it's huge, mm-hmm. right? Not letting kind of resentments develop.
Yeah.
But really kind of forming a team together such that nobody has to be primarily an advocate.
Yeah.
Right? We're all advocates for the kid. And that can, I think, create really powerful collaboration.
Yeah. I want to go back to the piece that you pulled out from Augustine with his striking phrase, strange vocation, because I want to relate it to that idea of all of the students being formed, because classical education is, you know, centrally about anthropology and, you know, what it is to be human and forming our humanity, you know, calling that forth. So what is it that is missing when schools don't do this? What are the blind spots that we're shaping, you know, kind of reinforcing these blind spots within ourselves, within our students, when we're not welcoming and including, you know, kind of all of these particular callings that God has?
Yeah, so I think that the anthropology, the understanding of what it is to be human that undergirds the entire classical project
mm-hmm.
is this open anthropology, right? We are open to the transcendent, which means we receive our nature, we receive our being, we receive our telos from outside of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so the two ways I talk about it are that it's an anthropology, it's an open anthropology, three ways, I guess. It's an open anthropology. It's an anthropology of being rather than an anthropology of doing,
mm-hmm.
right? You have the telos that you have, not because you have certain capabilities,
mm-hmm.
but because of the kind of being you are.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, the kind of corollary to that is that it's an anthropology of relationship rather than an anthropology of accomplishment,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So our main focus is not, how high can you fly? What can you do, right? What are you going to accomplish, right? This is like our American ethos, right?
Yeah.
But what are you? Mm-hmm. Who are you? Mm-hmm. Whose are you?
Yeah.
And that whose are you, right? God's first, but then the whole community.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we set up these communities of classical schools that say, that are trying to lead us towards this idea, whose are you? We are human beings in relationship to one another. That's part of what it is mm-hmm. to be human. We are not isolated individuals.
Yeah.
What are we telling our students? How are we teaching that to our students when we have kind of created this artificial community that doesn't have students who are different?
Yeah.
Right? That doesn't welcome people who are not that kind of excludes certain people because they're not capable of achieving certain levels of doing.
Yeah. It says something about the belonging of everyone.
Yeah.
When there's certain folks that we've more or less made so they can't belong or don't belong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's warping, warping the anthropology, the understanding of every student's relationship to each other, to God. Are there any particular, funding or legal resources that you would, this is just, I keep coming back to the kind of sheer intimidation factor or, whatever the right phrase would be, just that you would point people to as an encouragement or a help potentially as they think about, okay, maybe I'm going to take the course. I want to hear why. Will there be help in there to say, maybe I can do this?
So a couple of different thoughts there. The first is that there are some resources that are available to you through your public school districts,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think sometimes classical schools, we define ourselves against public education, right?
Yeah.
And we don't realize that, you pay your taxes, right?
Yeah.
And there are
there
are resources that are available to us through those public school systems that don't require us to go to public school.
Mm-hmm.
And so some things you can only get if you go to the public school, but if you can show that testing is warranted through a certain systems of documentation and things like mm-hmm. this, at the very least, certain children can qualify for testing, which when you try to fund it privately is extremely expensive. And the public school is required to develop an IEP, an individualized education plan for mm-hmm. the child. Now, if you're sending them to a private school, neither the public school nor the private school are legally obliged to follow it.
Yeah.
But hearing what their suggestions are, I think, can
be a helpful resource.
A helpful resource. And so, and I can't speak any more specifically than that because every state works differently.
Yeah.
But figure out how to do that for the kind of school administrator, right?
Yeah.
And I think this can actually be a really powerful form of welcome for schools. If the school administrator knows how to do it and has cultivated good relationships with the people in the district, which can be tricky.
Yeah.
That is such a gift to parents who otherwise just have to figure it out as though this has never happened to anyone before.
You can you can support and serve parents through that kind of bureaucratic process.
Yeah. And that's a huge support. And it's a form of welcome in and of itself. I'm willing to help you do this.
Yeah. And give everyone the confidence that, their professionals are with us as well as, with the public school system. We've got a team here that extends beyond our immediate, independent or Christian school community.
Yeah, for sure. Let's make the use of the best of the resources that the broader society has to offer. And sometimes students even qualify for services provided either in your school or after school.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can explore those options.
Yeah.
I think another thing to think about is, maybe we don't have a whole full-fledged program yet. Can we have one teacher who's particularly attuned to these issues? And can half of her job be to consult with the different teachers in the school about the kids that are already there?
Yeah.
I guarantee you that in almost any classical school you walk into, you have kids with ADHD. You have kids who are on the spectrum. You have kids who have various learning disabilities. They're already there.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you dedicate kind of half of one faculty line mm-hmm. to a teacher who is particularly attuned and good at unpacking and assisting those students to kind of consult? And that's sometimes the beginning of a program, right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you can't do everything, but what small thing can you do?
Yeah.
What creative thing can you do?
Yeah. Great. This feels related, the topic of disability in education feels related to me to other kinds of challenges that we have to overcome in society, with differences in income, between families, ethnic, racial background categories that can, you know, be areas of difference, you know, between students and families. Does that come up in any of the graduate course conversations, or you know, do you see that area of overlap, you know, trauma in trauma-informed kind of mm-hmm. approaches to education? Are there relationships there? Are there benefits to your approach to kind of anthropology and this, does it apply elsewhere?
I mean, I like to think it applies elsewhere, because when we're doing anthropology, right, we're talking about the whole of humanity, right? I do spend an entire day in the graduate course on the question of race and special education.
Yeah.
There's a deep literature on this question, a deep and complex kind of mm-hmm. relationship between how we navigate those intersections in our culture. And so we stop and talk about that mm-hmm. In the on-grounds course. Mm-hmm. And so certainly that's – and I think that our thoughts about difference generally apply there as well. But in different ways, not necessarily always on exactly the same metrics.
Yeah.
In terms of trauma-informed teaching, this is an area that I'm increasingly interested in. Techniques for trauma-informed teaching and techniques for universal design often go hand in hand. And I'm really interested. I'm sure there's a literature about this that I'm just beginning to tap.
Yeah.
Trauma and disability often present in similar ways in the classroom with similar kinds of behaviors.
Yeah.
And so even kind of discerning to what degree do we even know whether it's to what degree do we even need to know whether a behavior is coming from trauma or coming from disability in order to meet it where it is, right? Behavior is communication, right? I think is a really helpful place to start. Mm-hmm. Thinking about students with trauma and how to serve them and how to distinguish, right? Because there are places where kind of meeting the needs of a student with trauma are going to be different from meeting the needs of a student with a particular disability. And so I think trauma-informed teaching and universal design really need to kind of go increasingly hand in hand. And I'm excited to do some more research into that area, but I haven't done a ton yet.
Yeah. Can you give a just a brief definition of universal design and just the background of that?
Yeah. So universal design is an approach to education that tries to anticipate difference in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So the kind of old, you should be called inclusion models, sometimes mainstreaming if you go really far back, want to say, okay, we're doing what we're doing in the classroom, and we're going to offer students with disabilities accommodations, so kind of special privileges, basically, so that they can do what we're doing.
Yeah.
Right. It sounds great. But what it actually does is to say, okay, we're designing a classroom without you in mind, and then we're trying to squeeze you into it.
Right.
I think is how this ends up working out in practice, however beautiful the theory behind it might be. Universal design says, okay, we're going to start from the assumption that we're going to have difference in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to start from the assumption that there are going to be a variety of sensory needs, a variety of attention needs, right?
Yeah.
A variety of physical needs. And we're going to build our whole classroom environment on that assumption.
Yeah.
And so hopefully you can see that how powerful that is in terms of reframing. So
you're not the exception.
Right. We all belong from the start.
Yeah.
And what I love about it is that even if a certain element of that design is inspired by the needs of a particular set of students, by the needs of a set of a student who has kind of high sensory needs or something like this, high sensory sensitivities, they end up benefiting everyone.
Yeah.
Right. So the kid who's just having a day, right, has the same kind of supports available to him as the kid who always is having a day, right?
Right.
Every day is that day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just allows us to all be more human together.
Yeah.
And so I think that that idea of universal design is really powerful.
Yeah. Thank you. That's really helpful. There's a lot of, you know, really challenging and profound theological, you know, questions and, raised by this. Augustine's concept that you've shared a little about of a strange vocation puts it in terms of providence and gives a positive purpose to something that is also, you know, a kind of suffering. And yet suffering is, you know, result of the fall in a lot of traditional Christian, you know, categories of thought. Do you get into questions of kind of eschatology and, you know, fall within your graduate course, or how would you, you know, very specifically Christian kind of theological questions, maybe outside of the framework of, you know, empirical history, you know, healing and, you know, the sense in which obviously we all need healing. You know, how do you get into any of those kind of theological questions? I'm really asking something that at this point's a bit of a personal question, just because I'm interested, you know, in this topic. So sort of asking selfishly.
We definitely get into those topics pretty deeply. Yeah. In the kind of on grounds course.
Yeah.
We ask those questions. One of the authors I read, Brian Brock, has a wonderful book, Wondrously Wounded, where he really wants to take an eschatological, I think almost instead of an anthropological, so I fight with him a little bit there, approach to these questions. But he's pointing to eschatology. He's pointing to how we think about kind of our ultimate telos, and the relationship between disability and that telos, between suffering and that telos, are tied together, is, I think, a really important thread to weave through. The questions of fall are really interesting ones, and you'll find that different people are going to respond differently to that, right? To what degree is disability, and what kinds of disabilities come from the fall?
Yeah.
Right. It's a really fraught question.
It's for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
You only exist because we are fall. Right.
Right.
Especially when you get into questions of identity.
Yeah.
Right. And how this works, I think, is so distinct to different disability communities. I always say, and you might get sick of it if you listen to the lectures, disabilities and learning differences.
Yeah.
Because I want to make sure we don't lump everything together into the category of disability, right? 40% of the Rhode Island School of Design has dyslexia. Is dyslexia a disability? Well, depends what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So I want us to be careful.
It's an asset.
Right. It's an asset, right? Yeah. 40%, I think, you know, the percentage of dyslexia in the population is much lower than 40%, right?
Yeah.
Than 40% of the Rhode Island School of Design.
Yeah.
But that's kind of getting away from the specifically theological question.
No, it's related for sure.
So I think even, framing of the topic. Where do our terms come from, right? Why do we think about it this way? And is that a Christian way to think about it?
Yeah.
What I find really fascinating, one of the things I find very fascinating there is when you dive back into the medieval literature, this our contemporary concept of disability doesn't exist, right? There's like misfortune, right? Or weakness, or the least of these. But that includes, on the broadest level, everyone.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. John Swinton is a contemporary author, has a wonderful line. People with disabilities and people who do not consider themselves disabled. It's a great line.
Yes.
And this is a medieval thing that we're all fellow travelers, right?
Yeah.
And so we are called to act as Christ to one another along this way where we are all participating in Christ's brokenness and listen to prophetic voices where they come. And so I don't know, there's multiple threads kind of feeding in there. Should we always be talking about suffering, right? Where do our ideas of disability come from? And also kind of if we're looking at things through a Christian lens rather than through a lens that's kind of been largely hammered out in an, I would say, post-Christian culture.
Yeah.
How does that change our perspective?
Some of what you're saying reminds me a little of the literature of Flannery O'Connor. And, you know, this idea of being awakened by and recognizing Christ in strange places. And are there connections and echoes? Are there literary connections, if not Flannery O'Connor? You know, what are some other ways to bring in poetry, literature? Mm.
We end the on-grounds class with a Flannery O'Connor story.
Oh, good.
So you're spot on, I think, in drawing her in. And I also have my students read a chapter. I'm going to blank on the name of the book, but Timothy Basselin has a wonderful book on a theology of disability in O'Connor. So if you put Timothy Basselin, theology of disability O'Connor in there, you'll get it.
You'll find it.
You'll find it. Reflecting on her own kind of explicit statements about her own disability, right? We sometimes, you know, her lupus that she struggles with, and this comes out in her letters more than anywhere else because she was very loath to talk about it and she never wanted it said that it had anything to do with her work. I mean, Color Me Dubious a little bit, but right, but I think she saw so clearly, and some of her characters are able to so fully embody it, probably because of her own experience, even though I totally hear her that it's dangerous to read too much of an author's story into a work. I think what O'Connor does really beautifully is gets this kind of sense of the prophetic possibility of the uncanny, right? Of the thing that just kind of throws you off. And she's just brilliant about it. And kind of, if you haven't squirmed a little bit in the O'Connor story, like you're not reading it right. which is not to say, right, which is to say that kind of this kind of perspective of openness to seeing the hand of God in the mundane, right? To kind of catching these glimpses, right? I think Hopkins would call it inscape, right, of the divine and its way of not quite lining up with how the categories in which we've broken down the world around us, I think is really powerful when we're thinking about this question. So ultimately, yes, I want us to all cultivate a sacramental imagination.
That's great. Well, thank you. This has been a delightful conversation. I feel like we could be just getting started when you, bring up a phrase like sacramental imagination. Thanks so much. Anything else you'd want to say in closing that we haven't touched?
I don't know. Thanks so much for having me is the main point. And I'm really looking forward to kind of seeing where these projects lead into opening up conversations about disability in classical education, because I think that this is somewhere where the classical renewal movement really needs to start devoting some energy. So I hope that...
Great. Well, we'll be pointing back to your professor page and asking people to keep networking with you. And I do hope this is just the beginning. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Classical U's podcast. Thank you for tuning in. We release podcast episodes once a month with our presenters. Please also check out our live learning events, webinars, in collaboration with Scholae Academy and Scholae Communities.